Good morning. I hope you all slept well on the diagonal. it's like Connect Four, isn't it, sleeping here? You know, you've got to be on the diagonal to win. Right. Strictly speaking, in Connect Four, you don't have to be on the diagonal to win. But on these beds, you do. Right. A number of years ago, someone who later became a bishop in the Church of England and then later on after that stopped being a bishop in the Church of England. So that's broad enough that you won't be speculating too much. Was a chaplain from Oxford College, and he used to say that he used to ask all the first year students to come and visit him in his office as the chaplain. And they would come, and it has been said that a number of them would be very resentful. And they would say something along the lines of, "I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know why I've come to see the chaplain, because I don't even believe in God." And he would say in that sort of wise chaplainly way, "That's very interesting. Why don't you tell me about the God you don't believe in?" And they would tell him. And he would say, "Well, then that's really interesting, because I don't believe in that God either. Let me tell you about the God I do believe in." You see, we all have this word in common, this word God. But what does that actually mean to you? What do you think about when you think about God? What is God like? Who is God like? So these students would say, "Well, you know, I don't believe in some old man with a beard sitting on a cloud watching angels strumming harps." And of course, having read the Bible, this chaplain was able to say, "Well, I don't believe in that God either. That's not the God of the Bible." So who is the God of the Bible? I guess that's what we really want to dig in at over the next 36 hours. And what we're going to do is we're going to spend some time thinking about who God is in himself and in his relation to creation today. And then we're going to talk about the Trinity tomorrow and the difference that makes for our relationships with each other and as a church. Okay, so that's the basic plan. But I want to get you guys to do some work because I'm fundamentally a very lazy person. So what I'd like you to do is turn to Isaiah chapter 40. And starting at verse 12, I'd like you to read Isaiah 40 from verses 12 onwards. And when you've read that very quietly to yourself, what I'd love for you to do is to split into groups of between 2 and 4. 5 is an absolute ceiling. 2 is the smallest you can have and it would still be a group, okay? Well, it's nice to have some boundaries. All right? So in groups of between 2 and 5, preferably 4, talk about Isaiah 40 and ask the question, what is God like? What does Isaiah tell me God is like? Okay? What does God tell me in his word that he is like in this passage? Okay? So quickly read through it, but carefully, and then talk to each other and see what you can draw out, everything you can find about who God is and what he's like. Okay, go. Okay, let's benefit from the wisdom in the room. I don't know about you, my experience of doing that sort of thing is that you sort of, you know, you go through undulating countryside when you sort of stop and look at something like Isaiah 40 together, in that you kind of, there's a load of initial stuff that you notice, and then you sort of exhaust maybe the really obvious stuff, if you're brave enough to say the obvious stuff, because often people aren't brave enough, are they? And then you have to sort of look at it and you think a bit harder, and then there's a whole load more stuff that comes, and then you're uphill again for a bit, and then, you know. So anyway, so it's worth doing it for an extended period of time is what I'm saying. You know, you won't get it all in 5 minutes, but what have you picked up in 5 minutes? What is God like? Who is he? What do we know about him from Isaiah 40?
He's like nobody else.
He's like...
Who else?
Brilliant. He's like nobody else. So what is God like? He's not like anything.
Specifically, he's not like man, he's not like idols.
He's not like man, he's not like idols. Fantastic. In fact, he's not like anything in the creation. To whom will you compare me? Now, if you learn nothing else this weekend, please learn that. God is not like you. I think I, for a long, long time in my Christian life, carried around this idea that God was basically like me, but just really, really inflated with a very powerful pump. So that he was... That's a horrible thought. There's some terrible stories of the bizarre from the world's press that I could now tell you, but I won't. But this idea that God is just like a kind of really kind of maxi human, just like us, but with kind of, you know, a bit better, a bit bigger, stronger, but, you know. No. God is not like us. He doesn't share any of our limitations. We'll talk about that some more in a minute. But who is God like? Nothing. Nothing. Okay, what else did you see from Isaiah 40? Yeah.
He's big.
Okay, go on. Take us to...
So verse 12.
Yeah. Big. Thank you. So there's a question of scale. There is definitely a question of scale. And Isaiah says, look, you need to think about just how vast God is. So why don't you, next time you have a bath or an excellent shower, see how much water you can hold in the palm of your hand. And it's the kind of thing you did when you were a kid, isn't it? And then you probably grew out of it. Well, grow back into it, okay? See how much water, I mean, you know, and if you're really sort of scientifically minded, see if you can fill a shot glass with the water you can hold in your hand. Okay, and then see how long it takes you to empty a swimming pool with a shot glass. And then if you manage that, that's a Chuck Norris fact, by the way, that Chuck Norris can empty a swimming pool with a fork in the rain. It's interesting, actually, you know, some great figures can walk on water while Chuck Norris can swim through land. but try emptying a swimming pool with a shot glass, and, you know, that's a pretty big deal. Okay, so how much water can you hold in the palm of your hand? Not that much. How many swimming pools are there in a big lake? Thousands, hundreds of thousands. And how many of those big lakes? I mean, we think of, you know, you think of a big lake in, you know, Loch Ness or Windermere or something. You think that's big. That's tiny. It's nothing compared to some of the big Canadian lakes. And then they're nothing compared to the Atlantic Ocean, which, you know, compare that to the Pacific Ocean. There is a huge amount of water. What I'm telling you is, if you try, shot glass is not a lot compared to all that water. Okay? There is a lot of water. And for God, it doesn't even make up a tiny part of an awesome shower. Okay? Have you ever been up a really big mountain? Yeah? Most of us, you know, if you've lived in this country, no, you haven't. but, you know, if you've been overseas and been up a really big mountain, it's scary, isn't it? You feel tiny. And with a big mountain, as you go up it, you start to realize, I can't really breathe. And you have to stop and you have to sleep overnight at different points on your way up the big mountain because you can't even stay alive if you just walk straight to the top. And to God, that big mountain is like a speck of dust that you wouldn't even notice. And you take all those big mountains and you can start weighing them. They're like flour. Okay, that is, he's giving us pictures and he's saying, look, you need to think about who I am differently. Your God is too small. And just in the same way as someone who's from a country that has real mountains might come to this country and say, you call that a mountain? That's ridiculous. Yeah, that's like a lump under my living room rug. God says, you know, what? Think of the biggest thing you can. Well, that's nothing. That's, you know, it's not even worth considering in comparison to me. Your God is too small. Our sense of scale needs to change. And here's some picture language. Here are some pictures to help you to think about how that changes. All the oceans in the world. All the mountains weighed on a little balance. Okay, what else? What else do we learn? Great. Take us. Where do you see that? Brilliant. Thank you. So he's not selfish with his power and his strength, is he? Actually, here is a God who, out of the overflow of his goodness, gives good things to people. And here is the God who is strength, and he gives strength to the weary. And, you know, I asked you to start in verse 12, but if you just cheat and go back to verses 10 and 11, as we're talking about God's strength, you know, here is God who comes with might, verse 10, and whose arm rules for him. And then what's his arm doing in verse 11? Here is the arm that rules the world, and what is it doing? Gathering the lambs in his arms. Here is a God whose might is beyond your imagining, whose power is just beyond anything you can possibly conceive of. As we saw when he's talking to Pharaoh in what Roger read for us a moment ago. And that power, what use does he put it to? To hold his people close. To protect his people. To gather his people. To love and nurture his people. So here is a God who is not just massive, but who is good. And astonishingly and breathtakingly good, as we'll see. Okay, anything else? He's eternal. Great, take us where? Great, so he's been there from the beginning. And he has no beginning and no end. So there is the everlasting God. He is the God who is there. There's never been a moment when he wasn't there, and there will never be a moment when he's not there. He is everlasting. He's eternal. Talk a bit more about that later on. What else?
He's all knowing.
Brilliant. Great. So, and verse 14 is really interesting, isn't it? Because he's all-knowing. He doesn't need anyone to help him. And then, as you say, verse 27, he knows our hearts. Our ways are not hidden from him. You know, there's no sense. So here is Israel complaining and saying, well, God, don't you know? Are you blind to what's happening to me, to us? Of course not. Nothing is hidden from him. From the greatest to the smallest, nothing is hidden from him. We'll talk more about God's knowledge after coffee. You'll need the coffee. Right. Anything else you've noticed? Brilliant. Take us there. Brilliant. 22 to 24. Sovereign over the affairs of man. Here is the one who raises princes up and brings them down. And you know, Do you not see that in a world that is so full of people looking to get power over each other, and some people who have just seemingly, you know, unmanageable power? I mean, I think that's one of the scary things that comes out of something like the Savile case, or in a much smaller way, the Lance Armstrong thing, is here are people who were untouchable, who seemed to have so much power they could do what they wanted and no one could stop them. I mean, it seems ludicrous, doesn't it, for a sort of cigar-toting kind of, you know, weirdo children's TV presenter. But people were genuinely frightened of Jimmy Savile, and no one wanted to take him on. But he is like grass, and the breath of God blows over him, and he is gone. And what was hidden will not stay hidden. And the evil that he did will not go unseen by God. And of course, in sort of world terms, Savile's small beer. But, you know, the greatest, most powerful of people, Mao Zedong, Joseph Stalin, people with unmeasured power, unmeasurable power in some ways, dust on the wind of history. God remains. his power is unchallenged and unchallengeable. Okay, anything else?
He does not faint or grow weary.
Great, okay. So verse 27. Verse 28. He does not faint or grow weary. So again, you know, God is never lacking in resources or reserves. He doesn't need anything. I need things. I need sleep. I need food. If I don't have them, I become initially tetchy and then unconscious. it's true. But God is not like that. God does not have needs. We'll talk about that. Anything else? Yeah. Verse 16 is astonishing. Has anyone ever seen a cedar of Lebanon? They keep on occurring in the Bible. You know, cedars of Lebanon, these great trees. And well, what are they like? I went to a family wedding a couple of years ago at a country house in Wales, and the person who had founded the house had planted an arboretum, and you know, with lots of different kinds of trees, and he had planted a cedar of Lebanon. Yeah, about 150 years ago. Man, I went for a walk round the tree. I sort of ran out of, you know, sort of slightly ran out of breath halfway around. It's big. I got an idea. You sort of think, oh, wow, okay, that's a tree. You know, you see a big old oak tree, a 600-year-old oak tree. It's nothing in comparison. It's a serious tree. And that it's tall and it's big and it's, you know, amazing. And take every single one of those in Lebanon and all the other trees that grow there and make the biggest fire you can. It will not be enough to burn the animals that you would need to burn to make a sacrifice that is suitable for who God is. His worth and his value and his glory and his holiness are such that the world cannot offer him what he is due. It does not have the resources. The greatest tree manufacturer in the known world, Lebanon, couldn't provide the firewood for that altar. God is worthy of more praise than you can ever give him. And if everyone in the world got together and decided to try and offer God as much praise as they could, they would not be able to provide what is needed or what is right or appropriate for God, given how glorious and how holy and how wonderful he is. I just think that's the most stunning verse. Verse 16. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. So not only is your God too small, and I can say that without fear of contradiction, because I'm sure he is, because you aren't capable of imagining how big God is. So by definition, your God is the God you know in your mind is smaller than the God who is there. But you're not capable of worshipping him either, not the way you ought to, not the way you should, not the way that's appropriate. Your God is not glorious enough. He is not holy enough. Because the God who is there is holy beyond your wildest dreams and worthy of more praise than you could ever give. What else? I'm going to go here first. Creator of the ends of the earth. Fantastic. Just take us to the verse so that we all see it. Verse 28. Thank you. Verse 28. The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. And in the scriptures, often what you get is something that's called a merismus. And a merismus is just where you mention the highest thing and the lowest thing, or the furthest thing to the left and the furthest thing to the right. And it's a way of saying the whole thing. We did it all the time. So you say, he was English from his head to his toes. You know, obviously that's an insult. You might say that as a way of saying that the whole person is completely, thoroughly, all the way through, an Englishman. Okay? From his head to his toes. The ends of the earth, from one end to the other, all of it. He is the creator of all of it. Do you see anything else about the creation in here? He's marked off the heavens. Okay, so again, he You know, he's bigger than the creation. He's capable of measuring it from one end to the other. So he's made it, but he also knows it. Anything else? Verse 22, so he sits above it. So, you know, and there's that picture. That's a picture, isn't it? Simultaneously of him ruling it and knowing it and seeing it. And it's a picture of scale, so that its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. You know, he stretches out like a curtain. What else about the creation? Brilliant. So the creation continues to depend on him. He continues to sustain the creation in being. So why is it that the same stars are there night after night after night? It's a lovely, it's a very quaint picture, isn't it, of God calling them out by name, like kind of, you know, sheepdogs or something. But that is the picture, is here is a God who knows every one of those stars by name. Those stars that are too numerous for any person to count. I read recently that, you know, it's very, very hard to decide whether there is more sand on all the beaches in the world or whether there are more stars. It's apparently, I mean, some people make a living at sort of trying to make those sorts of guesses. That's an interesting contribution. But I'm sure, oh dear. but I'm sure, you know, I'm sure it's a very important mathematical question. But, you know, that gives you some idea, doesn't it? Of just how many stars there are in the universe. God knows them all by name, and he keeps everyone in place by speaking. He calls them out by name. How did God create the universe? He created it by speaking, didn't he? Genesis 1 and 2. He spoke and it was. And so it is from day to day to day. God speaks and it is. You read that in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3 as well, that actually the Son of God sustains the universe on its course by his powerful word. So if you were thinking about a big mountain earlier, think about it again. In fact, I'd like you to close your eyes and think about the biggest thing you can think of, the most substantial thing you have ever come across in your life. Okay? And once you've closed your eyes, I'll leave. So close your eyes and think about it. Really think about it. And then I want you to imagine trying to push it and trying to make it move. Okay, now if you've chosen anything remotely big enough, it's not moving. Okay? That's great, thank you, you can open your eyes. Now, the reason I've asked you to do that is just to give you, just, you know, you need to think about how substantial the creation feels, okay? And how tiny you feel in relation to it and how massive it feels. And, you know, sorry, to come back to Chuck Norris jokes, you know, there's the, you know, when Chuck Norris does press-ups, he doesn't lift his body up, he pushes the earth down. sorry, I need to explain why this has come about. So this week, so have any of you come across something called Khan Academy? Okay, so there's a guy called Sal Khan, he was a hedge fund analyst, started doing like little sort of maths videos for his nephew who was, he's in New York, his nephew's in California, needed some tutoring in maths, he was very good at maths. So in the evenings he started putting together some videos for him. It's turned into this massive internet sort of sensation, and Bill Gates has described him as the future of education, and it's very cool. And my seven-year-old daughter is kind of working her way through Khan Academy videos. But we sort of left her unsupervised doing this. And she started looking at all kinds of stuff that was well... In fact, we got a message from the moderator of the Linear Equations forum saying, thank you so much for your posts, but they're a little off topic. So my wife sort of went and looked. And she'd been asking questions like, how long till Christmas and how large is the sun? Anyway, one of these videos, so anyway, one morning she came down and she said, Mummy, what was our Chuck Norris? And he'd been using like Chuck Norris's face as counters and said, okay, that's five Chuck Norrises and now we need to add another three Chuck Norrises. And so... the whole kind of Chuck Norris phenomenon became something in our household. So anyway, sorry, that's given you a chance to breathe. Right. You know, you push against something really just solid and huge and massive and try and make the earth, but it's not going. Okay? But the earth would stop existing in an instant if God stopped upholding it. That mountain you were trying to push without any chance of moving it would just vanish into nothing. It would just be gone. It does not exist if God doesn't uphold it. The stars in the sky would not appear. The sun would not rise. The creation is not independent of its creator. He made it out of nothing. Yeah, so in the beginning, there's just God, and then he creates out of nothing. There is nothing there. He doesn't start off with kind of, stuff that he then puts together to make the creation. There's nothing there. He makes it out of nothing. And if he stops sustaining it, it stops existing. Well, we're going to talk this afternoon about what that means in terms of human beings. But, you know, basically it means you're not independent of God. That you don't have an existence away from him. Your life means nothing without him. And if you think you can live for something other than him, you are lying to yourself and about yourself. And you are wasting your life. Because you only exist because God keeps you existing. And you would disappear like a dream should he stop upholding you. And the same is true of the whole universe. So he calls the stars out at night. He sustains the creation in being. Now, all that is by way of saying that the fundamental distinction in the scriptures, the fundamental thing we're told about in the scriptures, is that God is the creator and everything else is the creation. Now, I'm not sure that's how we think about the universe, because there are lots of other worldviews that are not shaped by the scriptures that are out there, and I think often we take them on board. So, for instance, a very, very ancient religion called Zoroastrianism has the idea that there are two ultimate forces in the universe, light and dark. Okay? And there is a good God and a bad God. And they are effectively equal and opposite to each other. And the existence of the universe is about their struggle between themselves. Okay? Now, that is not what the universe is like. The fundamental distinction in the universe is not between the good God and the bad God. It's not between good and evil. And it is not between natural and supernatural. Maybe that's another way that we think, that there's basically kind of two realms of being. The natural that we inhabit and the supernatural, where supernatural beings are somehow on a level with God. Now, the Bible is very clear that there are supernatural beings. There are such things as angels and demons that don't exist in exactly the same way that we exist and can do things that we can't do. In fact, just this week, a friend of my wife's, who she's been sort of sharing the gospel with over the course of a couple of years, sort of came to her very shamefaced to say that she'd been along with a friend to a card reading. And that this friend had then come and told her something about her life that was true and she didn't know. But she then found out it was true. Now, what do you make of that? What do you make of the fact that there is that kind of spiritual reality and that actually there are, you know, supernatural forces at work and people can know stuff they shouldn't know? It shouldn't surprise you at all. You know, constantly in the scriptures, you know, Paul comes across this slave girl who can tell the future. Because she's got a demon. The fact that there are things that are supernatural that are not of God does not mean that they're on a level with him. Because the fundamental distinction is not between natural and supernatural, any more than it's between good and evil. Actually, the fundamental distinction is between creator and creature. Okay, there are two kinds of thing in existence: God and things God has made. Okay? Two kinds of things, not three. Not God and things God has made and then other things that are independent of God, but God and things God has made. Now, that raises some questions for us, and the Bible answers some of them and doesn't answer others. like, why did God allow evil in his creation and that kind of thing. But everything, even supernatural beings that are in opposition to God, belongs to him. He made it. He sustains it. It is not independent of him. So, Satan is in no way an equal and opposite opponent to God. Okay? Satan is a creature who owes his moment-by-moment existence to his creator. That is what makes Satan such an abomination. He belongs to the good God. He owes his existence to the good God. And yet he hates him and is his opponent. And of course, that is what makes sin such a terrible thing, isn't it? I belong to the good God. And I owe every breath that I take to him. And every beating moment of my heart belongs to him. And yet, I choose to take that and use it in ways that offend him. Okay, so fundamentally, fundamentally, the universe is something that belongs to God and is made by him. And that is why idolatry, you know, which crops up lots in Isaiah 40, doesn't it? That's why idolatry is such a serious thing. Because idolatry is to worship the creature rather than the creator. To treat something that is not God, that belongs to God, as though it was God himself. And to give that thing the worship that God deserves. Okay, which is a good time for us to go to Exodus chapter 3. So the creation depends on God for its existence, but God is fundamentally different. So in Exodus 3, Moses, who's been out of Egypt for a while, is confronted, and you know the story. He's confronted by God, and God says, I want you to go. I've heard my people's cry. I'm going to send you to Pharaoh, verse 10, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And Moses says, who am I that I should go? And God says, no, what matters is that I'm going to be with you. And then Moses says, well, so who are you? Who shall I tell the people? What is his name? Verse 13. What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel. I am has sent me to you. And that's the Hebrew word, Yahweh, that used to be translated Jehovah. Okay, and it's just a version of the Hebrew word, I am who I am. Tell them, I am sent me to you. Now, what is the significance of God's name? Well, the first thing is that God gives himself a name. All the rest of us get given our names by other people, don't we? So when you're born, your parents give you a name, and then you go to school and your friends give you a different name. At least that's true for most of us, many of us. And your name means something. Your parents may not have meant to imply everything that your name means when they give you the name. They might just like the name. My name is Nicholas. It means the victory of the people. I think they just like the name. And then sometimes you get given a nickname like Stinky, and that does have a meaning. And wasn't my nickname, I promise. But names are important in the Bible, aren't they? And with key people in the Bible, God chooses their name. Think about Abraham. And God says, no, you will be called Abraham, the father of many nations. Or Saul, who becomes Paul in the New Testament. Or Simon, who becomes Peter, Cephas. On this rock I'll build my church. Or think about the birth of John the Baptist and his dad, who goes in to offer the sacrifices, and he's confronted by an angel, and that's frightening. And the angel says, you'd have a baby and call him John. And he's like, oh, I'm not sure I want to call him John. Fine. Well, you have some time to think about it. And during that time, you won't be doing much speaking. Okay. So he's silent for 9 months until he writes down his name is John. The name matters. And the angel says, you'll give him the name. And until you give him the name, that's it. speaking privileges are off. Now that's instructive, isn't it? Who gave you your tongue? God gave you your tongue, and if he wants you to keep using it, he'll allow you to, but he could take it away. All right? The name matters. Jesus. You are to call him Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. Names matter in the Bible. They're really important. They say something about who you are. Who gives God his name? God does. Who gets to say what God is like? God does. And what name does God give himself? I am who I am. What does that mean? Well, it means that God is dependent on nothing and on no one. Everything he has comes from himself. He is who he is. He is independent. He is radically different from the creation. The creation doesn't define him. It offers him nothing. He is who he is, radically independent, self-defining, self-existent. And that is what a word that you might come across. And I'm giving you just through the weekend, just three or four different Latin phrases, just because they come up in the books and it's helpful to know them. And they kind of capture something fairly profound if you get hold of them. So there's this concept of arseity. Okay, that is the idea that God comes from ar himself, se in Latin. Okay, arse. So God is from himself. The creation is not from itself. The creation is from God. But God is from himself. So God doesn't have goodness. There's not something outside of God that he participates in that is called goodness. There's no standard outside of God that he measures up to. You know, there's not some, you know, if you go to Paris, you can find out how long a meter is because the official meter is in Paris. Okay? Well, God is like that. He is the definition of goodness. What is good is what he says is good, is who he is. He doesn't have goodness. He is goodness. And so he is radically different from the creation. The creation is dependent. He is independent. What does that mean? Well, that means that God doesn't change. Nothing can change him. Nothing can make him into what he isn't already. Because he is self-defining, self-shaping, self-limiting. And it means that nothing in the creation is given to him. Do you remember in Acts 17? Perhaps you know Acts 17, where Paul goes to speak to the Athenian philosophers. And he says to them, look, even you know. You know, he says, you have an altar to an unknown God. Well, what you worship is something unknown. I'm going to make known to you. So you've admitted your ignorance, let's fill you in. But even you know that it's wrong to think that somehow the Creator should live in something made by human hands or should need food from us. God doesn't need what you have to give. That's interesting, isn't it? God doesn't need you. He doesn't need you to validate him. Doesn't need you to give him anything. He doesn't need your talents. He doesn't need your gifts. He doesn't need you. You have nothing to offer him. Now, you know, for the most part, you guys are young and talented, and, you know, there are all kinds of people who want things from you and need things from you. And you've got lots to offer. But God doesn't need anything from you. And when you're, as you are, young and talented and gifted, and you're always wondering, what does this person want from me? I mean, God doesn't want anything from you, in the sense he doesn't need anything from you. He doesn't need you for anything. So when God wants to have a relationship with you, it's because he wants to have a relationship with you. Because he loves you. So it's you bring nothing to the party. That is the astonishing thing about being a creature, isn't it? Is that your relationship with God is all about God's free and unmerited love. That is the only basis you could ever approach him. Look, you could go to Lebanon and cut down every tree and then kill every animal. And if you hadn't been arrested yet, you could make a pyre and you could say, here, God, here is my worship. Here is my sacrifice. And God would say, thanks. You'd be offering him nothing. You can only come to him because he's generous, because he loves you. Now, I think that is fundamentally the hardest lesson we learn as Christians. You know, accepting that, you know, God's love is simply because God loves, not because of something in me. And there's nothing you can do to make God love you any more than he already does. You've got nothing to give him. I genuinely think that is the hardest lesson that Christians have to learn in their day-to-day Christian walk. You contribute nothing that God doesn't have already. That's one thing. But another is that God cannot be without anything that is his and still be himself. Because he is, by definition, who he is. Do you see the point? That the definition and the thing itself are identical with each other. Because God is his own definition. So he chooses his own name. Now, when we talk about God being radically independent and radically different and not needing anything from you, it may be that one of the ways that you react instinctively to that is to say, or to think, does that make God very aloof? Does that make God very distant and very far away? And I want to say to you, no, exactly the opposite is true, and after coffee we'll talk about just how the opposite is true. Take my word for it for the moment. God is not aloof. He is not distant. He's not unrelational. Quite the opposite. But he doesn't change. You will not change him. You will not alter him in the slightest. Okay. So, what I said about God being self-defining, you know, the definition and the thing itself being the same, let me try and explain what that means. We're on the next page. It's all right. It won't take us long to get through every page, I promise. And this is what theologians often talk about in terms of attributes, okay, a thing having attributes. So to explain this, I'm going to ask you all to stand up. And now that you're standing up, I'd like to close your eyes again. That's all right. And now stand on one leg. I'm joking about that. So, it's like Simon says, isn't it? Right, okay, so seriously, though, close your eyes. And I want you to imagine a horse. Okay? Has everybody got a horse? All right, you can open your eyes. Okay, I'd like you to sit down if your horse was brown. Okay. This is not some kind of psychological experiment, right? At least not yet. All right. I'd like you to sit down if your horse had a plaited mane. Oh, Roger. Okay. So I'd like you to sit down if your horse was grey. And by grey, obviously, I mean white, because apparently that's what a... Yeah. Okay, good. Now I'd like you to sit down if your horse was dappled. You know, black and white, brown and white, maybe a little white sort of fleck on the chest, something like that. Okay, no. All right, good. Now I'd like you to sit down if your horse was pink. Oh, Ed, I thought you were moving there. Okay, no My Little Ponies this week. That's interesting. I always get a My Little Pony, but not today. Are you sitting? No. All right. And now I'd like you to sit down if your horse had a tail. Explain. Ah, so you couldn't see. Brilliant. Fine, you can sit now. That's great, but that's brilliant because that illustrates exactly what I want to illustrate. Which is this idea of attributes being, you know, essential and non-essential. So, I don't think we've been much dispute that all of you imagined a horse. Okay? Whether that horse was brown or grey or black or black and white or whatever other flavours horses come in, it was still a horse. Okay? And whether or not it had a tail, it was still a horse. And whether or not the mane was plaited, it was still a horse. Okay? Now, imagine that some nasty boys from the local village had got a bit overexcited one night and come out with a chainsaw and hopped off one of the legs. Now your horse does no longer have four legs. Is it still a horse? Yeah. Okay. So there are things that are true about the individual horse that are not necessary to it being a horse. Okay. And this is the idea of a non-essential attribute. I'm sorry if that's distressing, the picture of chainsaws and... I was hearing some gentle sobbing coming from there. this idea of the difference between essence, what it is that makes something a horse. You know, say, okay, it's a mammal, and that might be quite important. You know, it has the capacity to move. That may or may not be essential. But there's the essence of horseness, there's something that makes something a horse and not a pig or a trout, okay? But there are other things that might be true about an individual horse that don't belong to the essence of horseness. So it could be without it and still be a horse. So colour is a classic example, brown, white, grey. Still a horse, even though it's different from other horses. They participate in some way in the essence of horseness. All right. So what is essential is that which makes the thing what it is. Okay? So what is essential is that what makes the thing... And you know, we're kind of used to the word essential meaning something along those lines. But technically it is, you know, the thing that makes something what it is. What is essential to it being what it is. Okay? Now, for a horse, or for me, or for you, our being what we are is not dependent on those non-essential attributes. You know, I could dye my hair blonde and I would still be me. It would be horrible, but I would still be me. Okay? You get the point. So that is how attributes are normally talked about. Is they're things that may be essential or non-essential to you being what you are. And theologians have tended to talk about God having attributes. And some of them are to do with his knowledge. You know, God is omniscient, he knows all things, that is an attribute. Some are to do with his sort of moral qualities. Say, God is just, God is loving, and all those other kind of things. And the question is, what happens when you try to relate those attributes to each other? Does it turn out that some of them are non-essential? Well, it's fine when they obviously fit together, isn't it? It's fine, like, say, God's knowledge and God's justice. That's not a problem. You can see how those things coexist with each other without any trouble. But what happens when the attributes might seem to be in opposition to each other? What about God's love and God's justice? What if we were to play top trumps with the attributes? Celebrity death match, right? Love against justice. Because that is how people talk about it, isn't it? Think about titles of recent books. You know, Love Wins. Is that how our salvation happens? Because God's love, in the end, overrides his justice. You know, a few years ago, this was the big argument over Steve Chalk's book, The Lost Message of Jesus. You know, the idea is that God's love is just so big and so powerful that it just overwhelms everything else, and God's justice isn't necessary in the same way that his love is. So when love and justice come together, what you get is love. Love wins. But what happens to justice? Well, justice, you know, has to sort of fit in and gets kind of cut down to size so that love can win the day. All right? Now, is that a satisfactory way of thinking about God? You know, is that what the scriptures tell us God is like? Think about it for a moment. We've just talked about a God who maintains the universe in being by the word of his power, who rules over everything, who brings princes to naught, who is, you know, who calls the stars out, name, you know, one at a time by name at night. How would you feel about a God like that who did not have moral restraint? Who could, when it suits him, choose not to be just? I wonder how enthusiastic you're able to feel about a God like that. I have to say, I would be terrified of a God like that. And I don't think that's the God who's presented to us in the Bible. So, you know, in Romans you read, you know, God is both the one who is just and the one who justifies. This is the great mystery of the gospel. So what really happens? Well, the answer is there's no conflict. How do you make sense of it? Well, think of it like this. How does the Bible speak of God's attributes? Well, frequently, what do you see? Well, in 1 John, God is love. But also in 1 John, God is light. In 1 John 1. This is the message we heard from him and declare to you that God is light. That's where he starts. And what does it mean that God is light? God is searingly morally pure. When God is spoken of in terms of light in the Old Testament and the way light is used in the Old Testament, you know, light is good, justice, moral purity. God is searingly morally pure. So in 1 John 1:3 and following, what you see is this is a God who is so pure that no one who is unrighteous, no one who is walking in the darkness could ever have a relationship with him. Okay, that is what God is. He is light. He is love. And there are things we're told that are impossible for God. He can't lie. He can't die. He cannot deny himself in 1 Timothy. 2 Timothy, sorry. So what is this? What is the picture really? Well, the best way to understand it is to say that God is his attributes. Everything that is true about God is essential. Okay? So justice is an essential attribute. Justice is part of the definition of God. So in God, essence and attributes coincide completely. The definition of the thing itself. Everything that's true of God must be true of him. For him to be himself. And this is the idea of simplicity. Okay? And if ever there was a sort of poorly named theological term, it's simplicity, because you think, I'm not sure that's that simple. But it's profoundly helpful when you get hold of it. And the idea of God's simplicity is basically this, that God is his attributes. He can't be without anything that belongs to him and still be himself. So you can't cut God up. He's not like cheese. Okay? So cheese you can carve up into bits. God cannot be carved up into bits. He's not made up of different parts. There is one whole reality, and that is God. Okay? Now, what that means is if you were to say everything you could say about God's justice, you would actually have to say everything there is to say about God. Because God's justice can't be sort of taken away from the whole. He can't be split up into bits. Does that make sense? So, actually, to say everything that needs to be said about God's justice is to say everything that could be said about God. And that means that his justice is loving justice, you see? And to say everything that is to be said about God's love is to say everything there is to be said about God. So you would have to talk about how God's love is just love, righteous love. Does that make sense? So we tend to sort of, you know, and we may not have used the sort of philosophical terms and the sort of distinctions that tend to be used in the academy, but the basic idea is still there, that there are sort of bits of God that you can sort of split off and look at individually. And the fact is, no. No, God cannot be broken up into bits. Yeah, Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, God is one. And there is a fundamental reality to that, that God is one. He cannot be divided up. It's okay, we'll talk about the Trinity tomorrow. But he cannot be divided up. And that's a key thing about the Trinity, isn't it? Is you can't have the Father without the Son, and you can't have the Son without the Father. And actually, the names imply that. You know, I was not a father until my child was born. Is God Father fundamentally? Is the Father fundamentally Father, or is that something he becomes? You can't have the Father without the Son. But what this means is that all the different things that we talk about when we talk about God are different ways of expressing the one same reality. This simple, undivided, perfect being who cannot be without what is his. You cannot take anything away and still have God left at the end. And so simplicity and this idea of perfection go together, that God is completely perfect. Now, when we think of perfect, we think of someone whose hair is not out of place, who is immaculately dressed and, you know, got a first from university and, you know, fast-tracked to being a partner in the law firm or something. But that's not what perfection means when we talk about it in terms of God. I'm going to teach you another Latin term, so that's exciting. Buckle up. And this is Latin like Welsh, which is that it's really easy to understand if you speak English, because it's basically the same, but just with a different ending on the end. So lots of modern Welsh. Sorry, is there anyone Welsh here? Any Welsh people? That's very disappointing. I was born in Wales. I'm allowed to say this stuff. Lots of Welsh is just English with the ending eel put on the end. So you want to go bowling? Bwlio? You know? No parking, dim parcio. You know? Oh, have you got a telephone? Telefonio. Okay. So you all speak Welsh. Just put eo on the end of everything. So I expect to hear lots of Welsh conversation over the rest of the weekend. Latin's the same. It's just with us instead of eo. All right? So Thomas Aquinas talked about God as being actus purus. Okay? So translate for me, please, from the Latin. Yeah, or pure act. Okay, so that's the other thing. Actually, sorry, I didn't tell you that. The other way that foreign languages try and trick us is by having a different word order. So sometimes you just have to get the word order right as well. So actus purus, pure act. What does that mean? What that means is that God is completely, completely without potential. He is pure act. He is everything that he could be all at once. Okay? There is nothing unfulfilled about God. He has no needs. He is everything that he ever could be, ever will be, ever can be. He is that all at once, forever. It's a breathtaking thought if you get hold of it. God is pure act. He is fully realized in all good things. There is nothing that should be his that isn't. He has never lost anything, and he will never gain anything, because he is fully realized in all good things. He is pure act. He is perfect. He has all good things. Now, what does that mean for you? Well, one of the things that means is that you can be confident that God can no more cease to be good than he can cease to be. God can no more cease to be good than he can cease to be. Because for God, the definition and the thing itself are the same. And God is good. God is light. That will never change. That will never fail. The God whose love is so great that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life, who gave his only Son for you, he will never change. If he makes a promise to you, he will keep it. And he could no more break his promise than he could stop existing. How much more security do you want? Your future in the Lord Jesus is as certain as that the universe ever came to be. Now, people are capable of doubting that the universe ever came to be. But if God has made promises to you, those promises are as certain as the fact that we are together now. More certain, indeed. This could be a dream. You might be thinking, well, it's not the most satisfying dream I've ever had. But it could be. But God is not a dream. And the promises he makes, he swears by himself in Hebrews. He swears by himself to keep his covenant with you. Isn't that an amazing thing? Isn't that an amazing thing? And something we didn't read in Isaiah, just as we finish, just one verse 11 of Isaiah 40. Verse 10. Behold, the Lord God comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. God is coming with his reward. And when you read Isaiah 40, ask yourself this question: what is God carrying? God is carrying his reward. What is he carrying? What is he bringing with him? His people. Isn't that the most extraordinary thing you've ever heard? This God we've been talking about, who is beyond your imagining, who is beyond your wildest dreams, thinks you are treasure and thinks about you as reward. His reward. A God who needs nothing. Isn't that amazing? I think we should pause and drink a lot of coffee.